I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The news today was a surprise and a little bit misleading. The CNN headline reads, "Last U.S. combat convoy has left Iraq." And indeed, we are seeing pictures of U.S. troops celebrating in Kuwait, having left Iraq a day earlier under great secrecy for obvious security reasons. But there are still 56,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, 6,000 of whom are also combat troops that need to leave Iraq by the end of this month to meet President Obama's pledge of ending combat operations by September 1st. Still, we may be witnessing the winding down of a 7-year war without much of a hullabaloo. Anthony Shajid joins us from Baghdad, where he's the New York Times correspondent in Iraq. And Anthony, we know that combat troops pulled back from Iraqi cities months ago. Now, the last U.S. combat convoy has left the country, but 6,000 combat troops remain. So explain.
Well, I think there is a little bit of debate over the semantics here, and these terms are often very pliable. As you pointed out, there are still 56,000 troops in the country. What left Iraq yesterday and arrived in Kuwait was classified as the last combat detachment. Now, all troops are technically combat ready, and I think we are going to still see, I hate to say this, but American casualties down the road. There is still some fighting going on. There are still tens of thousands of troops here. And so in some ways, this may be more of a symbolic moment than a moment that changes or shifts the reality on the ground.
And what will the remaining troops do?
Well, they're said to be support and training forces, but 50,000 troops is a lot of troops in this country, and there still is a little bit of a sensitivity on the part of Iraqis of such a big presence here. In fact, there's a debate that goes both ways. Under agreement signed by Iraq and the United States, those 50,000 troops have to leave by the end of next year. There are already starting to be whispers that that deadline might be extended. There are already angry statements that if it is extended, there will be protests. So how this deadlines or how this process plays out, I think it's going to be something that's going to be a little bit interesting. Again, it's going to be subject to different definitions. We're going to see semantics being employed here. We're going to hear terms that aren't always necessarily black and white.
And perhaps that's why we're not seeing the sort of big hoopla and celebration. First of all, as you say, the withdrawal isn't by any means complete. But also, as you wrote recently, the very nature of America's departure, leaving behind no government formed, an unpredictable Iraqi military, and deep popular disenchantment with a hapless political elite, might sort of temper the celebration now.
I think that's exactly right, Robin. I mean, we've often had, even since 2003, is a country here filled with American deadlines, American timetables, American benchmarks. And often those timetables and deadlines don't mirror the reality on the ground here. And I think this is the latest example of it. It's a deadline that's kind of playing along American domestic political considerations more than the reality in Iraq right now. It's a messy reality here right now. As you pointed out, there's no government. There's rising and very deep popular disenchantment with the elite. And there is, like I said, some suggestions or whispers at this point that these 50,000 American troops or some number of those troops may stay past the deadline of the end of next year.
Well, tell us more, Anthony. What is the mood? First of all, is their reaction, is this news in Iraq? Are they also seeing pictures of U.S. troops high-fiving in Kuwait?
You know, that's a great question. I think if you went out into any street in Baghdad right now and asked people, did they know the last combat troops or supposedly the last combat troops left the country, I'd guess that maybe two-thirds would have no idea that that was the case. You know, the American military presence, because of the withdrawal from the cities, you don't feel a part of everyday life here. I think what it's probably more indicative of is a waning American diplomatic or political influence in the country. When you look at what America means to most Iraqis, I think it's something that's receding. It's something that's not as visible as it once was. And if anything, it's less effective. The administration has made clear from the beginning is that this war is not its war. And we are seeing an American disengagement from Iraq. And I think it's interesting to ask that question, would we ever see any kind of change in the American posture here? Because it's so unpredictable today in Iraq. You do wonder where things are headed. You see this, as I said, deep popular disenchantment with the elite. You see a political class that's proven it's almost incapable of ruling the country. And there's a lot of people out there asking, what comes next? Are we going to see something that maybe goes beyond the formation of a new government in months? There's even whispers of a coup right now. There's suggestions of the current prime minister somehow staying in office. It's one of the most unpredictable landscapes that you've seen here in, I'd say, years.
Anthony Shadid, Baghdad correspondent for The New York Times in Baghdad. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, this has been quite a summer for three disabled American veterans. With one leg among them, they managed to scramble up Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest peak in Africa, more than 19,000 feet. Their six-day climb was part of something called the War Fighter Sports Challenge, a series of seven extreme events for disabled veterans. The climbers were Dan Nevins, whose legs were amputated after he was wounded in Iraq, Neil Duncan, whose legs were blown off by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan, and Kirk Bauer, who lost one of his legs in the Vietnam War. Well, we're joined by two of the climbers today, Kirk Bauer, who's also executive director of Disabled Sports USA. They run the War Fighters Challenge. And Neil Duncan, as we said, a veteran. And Neil, let's start with you. You know, people who have done extraordinary physical things always say they feel better after they're finished, partly because it's over. But do you also maybe even feel better because there's something physical that happened because you did do it?
I definitely feel accomplished. The story goes as this whole climb stemmed from a failure last year. And so, you know, it's even sweeter for me to have completed it and have that feeling of accomplishment, and as well as being able to see the following that it's gathered in terms of the press.
Well, there's that, but I'm wondering too, can you physically feel, is there a strength? Is there a blood coursing kind of thing? Is there something like that that you feel too?
Well, you know, Robin, this is Kirk. I think I can speak for Neil. Yes, you know, whenever you push yourself beyond what you think you can do and actually accomplish it, it does give you an extra sense of strength, and you actually are, you know, stretching your body's capacity and making it stronger. I think the saying is, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and I guess this is just one of those examples. But speaking for myself, Neil is in great shape, and I hope I was too, but it really stretched my limits, and it just was a great feeling to be able to actually, you know, get to those limits and then say, hey, you know, you've still got another 500 feet of elevation to get to the crater. You got to go. You know, you got to keep going.
And Neil, here you are climbing on two prosthetic legs. And by the way, I'm going to just acknowledge I've climbed Kilimanjaro. I'm not ashamed to say I was sick as a dog at 12,000 feet, almost froze at 19. Let's try to explain to people, this is not the technical climb that one can make, you know, with all sorts of climbing equipment up the ice. This is a darn long walk. Kirk, what are the challenges? What, just describe to people why it is so hard.
First of all, you're dealing with elevation. You're at 19,000 plus when you get to the top of Kilimanjaro, and none of us had ever experienced that high of an altitude. So you're short of breath, it's thin air, so even in the best of conditions, you're hurting. It does produce sometimes nausea and what have you. The other is just the physical exertion, you know, from 15,500 to 19,340, which is the top of Kilimanjaro. It's a very, very short distance-wise, but very steep climb with a lot of loose rock. And for guys with an artificial leg or two artificial legs in Neil's and Dan's case, you know, you take one step forward and your foot doesn't quite grab like, you know, you could do, so it slides back. Neil said he thought he climbed that mountain twice from Kibuhut at 15,000 just because there was so much slipping and sliding.
Neil, tell me how you did that, because there's this last leg. You have to get up after midnight when the scree, the sort of sandy side of the last leg up to the summit, it's what you picture when you picture the mountain. It's all ice and snow covered, and you have to go when the sand is frozen so that you can get some traction, but it is straight up. You do it in a switchback. How did you do that?
We approached it a little bit differently than the way that you more than likely did it. It took us 8 hours to climb that scree field. One of the things that was really helpful to me, and I'm sure for everybody else, it's also, of course, daunting at the same time, but you can see your point of finishing. You can see the crater rim. You could see it. It was right there, and we're so close to getting up to our camp for the night, being on a plane where it was going to be a relatively easy hike up to the summit, and so it was just one foot in front of the other, and, you know, having these other two guys around, and the whole expedition was motivating in that way, too, because, you know, the point was for all of us to make it.
The other thing, Robin, is a couple of things to keep in mind. We did, again, Neil mentioned we did a little bit differently because we have the disabilities and move much slower. Every time Neil takes a step, he has to place his foot someplace where it's going to hold, you know, where it doesn't tip over on a rock and whatever. So it's much more careful walking. And because of that, we actually camped at Stella's Point, which for your listeners is 19,000 feet. So we camped higher than the base camp for the Everest expeditions. And then from there, and, you know, you talk about cold. I'll tell you, you're right on the crater. the wind is whipping. It's at night, you know, it was freezing.
Right, and, really, how cold? How cold?
Well, it was below freezing. We know that.
Yeah.
There's ice, you know. I didn't have a temperature gauge, so I don't know, but it was definitely below freezing. And then the wind's whipping. And then that morning we got up and actually made the ascent to Uruhu, which is the very highest point on Kilimanjaro crater. And then we came back down to 15,000. So we did it a little bit differently than somebody like yourself would do again because of the disability.
But it's just astonishing that you did it, because when you say you got to Uruhu, yeah. Once you get up to the top, there's more. There's another 40-minute climb
yeah.
along a glacier to a higher elevation at Uruhu. Now you're on sheer ice.
At that point, we had set camp at Stella Point, and we, granted, not a very good night of rest, but everybody was rested by the next morning, and so we had, you're right, another 45-minute hike across the ice up to the top, but everybody was in real good spirits. You could see the summit. You could see the summit from our camp, as a matter of fact, and everybody was rested.
It sounds like, Neil, you're saying that a huge part of your success was mental, that you could see something. You could see something in the – you're saying those things as if they almost pulled you up.
Absolutely. I mean, knowing the end to anything that is taxing on yourself physically or mentally, knowing the point of completion is an incredible motivator.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, too, Kirk, you have the one prosthetic leg, and it's computerized, so it automatically adjusts for different terrains, but it froze above 15,000 feet. What impact did that have?
Well, about an hour out of the camp, I had brought a backup leg. But in order to save weight, we left stuff down at 15,000 feet camp, and I left my leg, which was really stupid, but I did it. And so about an hour out of camp, the battery died, and there's a picture of Neil trying to, you know, he's got a battery pack, and he was trying to restart it and get it charged, but we couldn't do it. So what happens in that case with my leg, I'm an above-knee amputee, so I have a hydraulic knee. It freezes up and becomes like a pig leg. You know, I look like pig leg Pete.
It's just unbelievable when you say, I left my leg, an extra leg down. But you have to be as light as you can possibly be. It's hard for an able-bodied person to breathe. And as you, when you say put one foot in front of the other and the last leg, that's literally what you're doing.
We had one good leg between us.
Amazing. That's Vietnam veteran Kirk Bauer, part of a three-man team of disabled American veterans who reached the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro on prosthetics. Kirk, as we said, had that one good leg but lost the other in Vietnam. We've also been speaking to Neil Duncan. He lost his legs to a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. There's a photo of Neil climbing towards the summit at hereandnow.org. Check that out. And we also want to congratulate the third member of the team, Dan Nevins, an Army sergeant who lost his legs in Iraq. Dan made it to the top, but got altitude sickness. He had to be evacuated, but we want to acknowledge him as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, what else are disabled vets doing through the Disabled Vets USA program? We'll ask Kirk and Neil about that. And later, the U.S. and its allies ramp up humanitarian aid to Pakistan, but as the BBC's Lise Doucette tells us, Pakistanis will take help wherever they can get it. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Kirk Bauer and Neil Duncan. They were part of a three-man team of disabled vets who recently reached the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro at more than 19,000 feet. It's the highest peak in Africa, and they did the climb on prosthetics. Kirk Bauer lost his leg in the Vietnam War. He's now executive director of Disabled Sports USA. And both of Neil Duncan's legs were blown off by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. And Neil, before the break, we mentioned the third member of your team, Dan Nevins, another double amputee, he from the war in Iraq. Now, he got altitude sickness at the top. He had to be evacuated. And we're betting you know how he felt, because you had to turn back completely once yourself. That's last year when you tried to climb Kilimanjaro. But you made it this time. So what was the difference?
Planning. In one word, planning. Last year, the people had put it together, had little to no experience with disability, the accommodations that need to be made concerning the situation. I obviously have that experience personally, and I've been around these guys long enough to know what we need to be successful. And so this year, the big difference was I started working on it with the head guide, and he had climbed with us last year, so he knew a lot of the situations that we were dealing with, and we put together such a strong plan with an incredible amount of flexibility that allowed for extra time, extra, you know, different routes, different sites in which we might need to set camp. And so there was always a contingency plan. There was always a B and a C. And that's how we were successful this year.
And
I also think it was training, Robin. One of the test events in order to get us in shape was an event in March. So that was midway from the time we started planning in December to the time we actually did it. And it's a 26-mile hike in the desert with a backpack. And so the test was you had to finish that in order to start to prepare for Kilimanjaro.
We understand that's the Bataan Memorial Death March, of course, memorializing the march that U.S. troops were forced to make during World War II.
That is correct, yes, yes. And it's a great event, but it also was an event to help prepare us, certainly me, to get ready for Kilimanjaro. And then a lot of hiking preparation. Neil climbed a couple of 14,000 footers in Colorado because he lives in Denver, and that also went into the planning as well. But we had a great guide, just did a great job in planning the course and having us go slower than you would normally do. We did 8 days. The normal course would be 5 or 6 days. So we took a couple of extra days. We had some other days filled in case we needed them. We didn't need them, but it certainly did help.
Well, I just got to say, the joke is that the slower you go, what do they say in Swahili, poli poli?
Yeah.
The better it is. I mean, that makes you a better climber.
Well, it also helps you acclimate to the altitude.
Yeah.
I know that Neil and I both feel personal accomplishment, but we also did this. I've been involved with Disabled Sports USA now for 40 years, since I lost my leg in 69 in Vietnam. And one of the things we really want to try to impress upon your listeners who have disabilities, our friends out there, is, you know, this event, if you will, it was designed to really try to motivate people with disabilities to get involved in sports and recreation. They're going to lead a healthier life. They're going to lead a more fulfilling life if they do. You know, we're not advocating climbing Kilimanjaro, but if three veterans from three different wars in two generations with one good leg between them can do it, we hope that our disabled friends can get out there and bike a mile or walk a mile or swim a mile and really get active in sports, because it's a great way to lead really a healthier life and a more enriching life. So that's the bigger picture that we're trying to push on this whole hike.
Well, and Neil, what would you say to fellow troops who'd say, the last thing I want to do is be reminded of what I once was? What would you say?
I've had those feelings myself, but there comes a point where you have to realize that, you know, you've incurred disability and things aren't going to change, you know, and my legs aren't going to grow back. But if you can grab hold of the situation and take control of it, there are no limits. And that's one of the points that we were trying to make with this climb. Aside from, as Kirk said, aside from personal accomplishment, the message was there are no limits. If one good leg between the three can make it to the summit of Kilimanjaro, what can anybody do for that matter?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's a great message.
And I think Neil is a living example of that philosophy. You know, you face a situation that's a reality. It's a new reality for, you know, after he got blown up in Afghanistan, you know, he had to deal with that, and he did, and now he is taking control of his life and is doing things that many of us never thought possible. And I think he's a living example of that whole philosophy of taking control of your life, realizing, okay, things are different, we got to do them differently, but I can still lead a full and active life. And Neil certainly is doing that.
It's just incredible. It reminds me of, I met a man once who lost a leg, and he said to the doctor, gosh, doc, you know, does this mean I won't be able to run a marathon? And the doctor said, well, if you really try, maybe you could. And he said, oh, good, because I couldn't before.
Well, you know, that's true. We had a Native American who from Alaska who lost both legs, and we had him skiing within 3 months of losing both of his legs. Yeah, we had him snow skiing, and then we trained Disabled Sports USA through our sports program for the Wounded Warriors, trained him to be certified in scuba diving, and he went down in the Caribbean scuba diving. He said, you know, Kirk, I've lost my limbs. But he says, you know, as a Native American from Alaska, who would have ever thought that I would have the opportunity to get certified in scuba in the Caribbean, you know? Yeah. And for him, it was a new opportunity and a new way to do things.
That's Kirk Bauer, a Vietnam vet who lost a leg during that war. And we've also been speaking with Neil Duncan, an Army sergeant who lost both of his legs to a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. Together, along with Dan Nevins, who lost both legs in Iraq, they summited, climbed Mount Kilimanjaro earlier this month. Just incredible. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, let's take a second for a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, some scientists say there's more oil left in the Gulf than BP or the government claim, and they say it could be working its way up the seafood chain. We'll take a look at that. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Henry Winkler is back. We'll speak with him about his current TV projects, Royal Pains and the new wacky comedy Children's Hospital, not about children. Latest news is next, Here and Now. New York Archbishop Timothy Dolan is now entering the fray over plans to build that Islamic center blocks from ground zero, the Archbishop saying he wants to help mediate the dispute. How did the proposed center become the center of such a firestorm? Last week, a New York Times report said the project was cursed from the start because of public relations missteps. But Salon.com did a search of press reports and found that's not true. The Cordoba House idea was launched last December with applause, and the controversy wasn't ignited until 5 months later by a right-wing blogger who's long railed against Islam through her organization Stop Islamization of America. Justin Elliott of Salon.com did the research. He joins us. And Justin, let's go through the timeline. You found the first story back on December 8th, 2009. This one also from the New York Times, but it was largely positive. Explain.
The Times published a front page story on the project, and they quoted Jewish leaders and city leaders supporting the imam. And it really didn't garner much reaction. One conservative blogger named Pamela Geller picked up on it and became sort of obsessed with it, but other than that, no national political figures weighed in until many months later.
Well, saying in December, a couple weeks after that New York Times article, Laura Ingraham, conservative talk show host, sits in for Bill O'Reilly, interviews the imam's wife, and says this.
I like what you're trying to do, and Ms. Khan, we appreciate it, and come on my radio show sometime.
So Justin Elliott, Laura Ingraham applauds the project. And then you found no other response, no other mainstream articles for the following 5.5 months, nothing?
That's right. Even though there was a big feature on this on the front page of the New York Times, no one really noticed. I think no one had been told that they needed to be upset about this at that point.
Well, but as you noted, a blogger named Pamela Geller was writing about it on her blog, Atlas Shrugged. We're now in May, 5 months later. The New York Community Board votes to approve the project, and Geller launches a campaign. What was that?
The community board voted to approve the project, and there was some local press on it. It was not called the Ground Zero Mosque at that time. That term really didn't exist. But Pamela Geller, this conservative blogger, her post that day was titled Monster Mosque Pushes Ahead in Shadow of World Trade Center, Islamic Death and Destruction. And for the next few days, she was hitting on it every day. And then on May 13th, the New York Post picked up Geller's coverage in an article. They quoted her at length and talked about, I think the headline was Mosque Madness, and that was really the turning point. A lot of conservative commentators read the post, and it blew up at that point.
Now, this was a column by Andrea Pizer. You say this was the first newspaper article you found that framed the project as negative and, in fact, quoted Pamela Geller. And what happened from there?
Well, at that point, you saw people like Sean Hannity had Pamela Geller on his radio show, the Washington Examiner, Investors Business Daily, some conservative-leaning newspapers editorialized against the project. And then politicians started to weigh in. Rudy Giuliani called it a desecration. Within a couple months, you had the famous Sarah Palin tweet, peaceful Muslims, please refudiate. And so then, you know, political reporters started covering it, and we had the controversy as we know it today.
Well, and coming full circle, Laura Ingraham, again, the only conservative to weigh in on this several months ago when it was first announced, and to then weigh in on it positively, now says that the building of the mosque means the extremists have won. Justin, it would seem that no matter what side of this issue you are on, you'd have to say that this is an example of a successful blogger.
Definitely, very much. And the remarkable thing about it is that Pamela Geller is really not a sort of mainstream Republican conservative blogger. She, I think even Republicans would acknowledge, is a conspiracy theorist. She famously wrote a post arguing that Malcolm X is Barack Obama's father. She has bought bus ads telling people to leave Islam in New York City. But yes, this was remarkably successful. She was really alone on this issue for many months, and then it got picked up by the New York Post and blew up from there.
Justin Elliott, a reporter for Salon.com. You can read his timeline on the proposed Islamic Center at our website, hereandnow.org. Justin, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, your thoughts? You know, hereandnow.org. Just go there, click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there. And by the way, while at our website, we're looking for tacky tourist photos. We've posted some on our website under Notes and Updates. We'd love to share yours for a story next week. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. The UN is holding an emergency meeting today to further help Pakistan with its worst flooding in the country's history. Some 8 million people are in urgent need of assistance. As many as 20 million people are affected, and tens of thousands of villages remain underwater. Senator John Kerry is in the region, as are 19 Marine Corps helicopters deployed to hard-hit areas to deliver $90 million worth of aid. Kerry saying, "We don't want additional jihadist extremists out of this crisis," as he announced that the U.S. would increase aid to $150 million, a nod to the fact that Pakistanis are turning to Islamic charities linked to terrorist groups for help. The BBC's Lise Doucette joins us now from Islamabad. And Lise, the floods have receded from northwest Pakistan, so you've been able to see some of the devastation left behind. Give us a picture.
Well, yes, I just happened to be in northwest Pakistan, the first to be hit by this huge national disaster. And there were vast areas that were inundated, including large stretches of the main highways. So the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, as it's called, was completely cut off. The roads are more or less open now under a blazing hot sun. The floodwaters have receded, and we were able to visit some areas such as villages and refugee camps that were either surrounded or swallowed by water. And they revealed the devastation, but it is a horrible sight to see. I have to say that when I walked into the Azakhel refugee camp, which sadly sits on the banks of both the Kabul and the Swat River, I was reminded of the pictures, the images I had seen when I was in Aceh, the worst hit area of Indonesia during the tsunami crisis of 2004. It was completely flattened. The only building left standing was a mosque, a concrete mosque painted white with pretty minarets. The rest was a scene of devastation, with brick houses reduced to piles of bricks and a lot of mud and straw and sticks and possessions strewn everywhere. And in the last pool of water, which still hadn't receded, there was a sign from the school that's protruded, and it said, "Welcome to our school." And the school books were strewn everywhere in the mud. And some of the school children had come back along with adult men, and they were trying to salvage whatever they could, because this is all that's left of their lives. So they were piling up bits of wood, trying to find things in the mud. And I met a 10-year-old boy named Kukum, and he was completely covered in mud. He had a sack across his back. And we said, "Kukum, why did you come back?" He said, "I came to find my shoes." And he showed us. He found his shoes. But that's all. That's all that was left.
Well, and Lise, we understand that in some of these camps were actually Afghan refugee camps. These were Afghans who'd fled the war in Afghanistan, come to Pakistan, and what little they had, they now lose.
Well, indeed, that was an Afghan refugee camp, Azakhel. It was home to some 30,000 Afghans. The camp was first built as 30 years ago when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and there was millions of Afghans left their country, many of them taking refuge in neighboring Pakistan. And as with all of the Afghan refugee camps, they soon changed from tented structures to being proper towns. And this was a proper town, and it was simply washed away by the force of these floods. It was extraordinary to see.
It sounds as if any help would be welcome and would be desperately needed. But I just want to ask you, is there the danger of a sort of proxy funding battle shaping up here. I mentioned that the U.S. is flying in aid. So is Saudi Arabia. They've pledged $80 million. Again, welcome, I'm sure. But Saudis have also reportedly funded the spread of hardline Islamic theology in Pakistan. And as we know, Pakistanis have had to turn to the Islamic charities linked with some terrorist groups for help. So is there a sense that now there may be a tug of war over the relief effort?
Well, there's always that danger in these situations where it becomes a battle for hearts and minds as well, a battle for sympathies. But for now, the Pakistani authorities, at least the relief officials and certainly the people that I've met on the ground, say they want to have water to drink, they want food to eat from anyone who brings it. And therefore, whatever charity is able to be organized enough to reach the people who need it the most, that's what it's about now. It's a battle for physical survival. But it was noticed that when Senator John Kerry and the Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari stood together, they did both mention the concern that Islamic extremist groups could try to exploit this situation. So in the long run, there are risks. But for right now, it is a humanitarian crisis. Pakistan is turning to all of its friends, whether it's the Saudi government or the Chinese government, the American government, all the UN agencies to help it, because now it simply wants to reach millions, because millions are not being reached.
Well, and the country's in danger of becoming a vacuum. A senior official with the UN had warned about what floods always leave behind, and that's disease. What are you seeing?
That is true. For days now, the United Nations has been saying that there is a risk of what it calls a second wave of death, because in some parts on the plains, water remains in place. It doesn't surge southward, so it becomes stagnant water. People move through that water. It quickly becomes contaminated, and there's a risk of epidemics of waterborne diseases, and that includes cholera. I spoke to the senior relief official yesterday in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, and he talked about how every day there was a false alarm, people saying, oh, there's cholera spotted in the Swat Valley, where, as you have probably heard, there's not a single bridge left standing, and so much insanitary conditions, people living in very desperate conditions indeed. But so far, the health authorities are trying to keep a very careful eye. And in fact, UN officials are saying that when they treat children for watery diarrhea, which is quite widespread when you have so many children affected, they treat it as if it's a possible risk of cholera because they're not taking any chances.
Liz, in the minute we have, how are Pakistanis speaking to you about their government? We understand Pakistan's president made another trip out of the country, his second since the flooding. What's your sense of anger?
Well, there is a lot of criticism. There was criticism when Asif Ali Zardari continued his European tour, going to France and Britain, and not just France, to his chateau in France. He defended his trip, saying he was the president, that there was a government at home who was dealing with this crisis. He had to deal with issues of terrorism, support for Pakistan from some of its friends. But there's a lot of politics in this crisis, the kind of politics which relief officials say gets in the way, and that's bickering between provincial and federal authorities who often belong to different parties, and also concern among the people that their president and other leaders are not taking the lead in what is truly Pakistan's hour of need. That criticism is not going to go away. President Zardari still seems comfortable, but the opinion polls before this crisis began put him at 20%, so perhaps it's not something he's worrying about.
Welcome back.
I wasn't always the cool person you see standing before you here today. I see you're shocked. Yes, there was a very, very brief time during which I was a nerd, until it came along. Mr. C, it made me different. It made me special. My bike made me the Fonz.
And Henry Winkler was the Fonz for 10 years on Happy Days, from 1974 to 84. Since then, he's worn many hats, producer, director, children's advocate. But now he's back on a regular TV series, two of them. Although, come to think of it, they're hardly regular. Royal Pains is currently in its second season on the USA Network and premiering this Sunday, season two of Children's Hospital, a crackpot comedy that started on the web and will now air with Henry Winkler joining the cast on Sunday nights at 10:30 on the Cartoon Network's Adult Swim lineup. Children's Hospital, run by a Dr. Childrens, also stars Rob Corddry, who co-created the show, and Megan Mullally from Will and Grace. And Henry Winkler returns to Here and Now to tell us more about it. Henry, two shows, not bad.
You know, I'm living the expression, when it rains, it pours. I put out the energy. I said, this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to be on a wonderful series. And I hit the jackpot twice.
Yeah.
First, I was asked to be in this ensemble comedy, and it's called Children's Hospital. It has nothing to do with children, and it's located in Brazil. Nobody speaks Portuguese.
It's basically a spoof of all the medical dramas we've ever seen.
And then some.
And then some. Let's listen to just a little bit of the preview.
Previously on Children's Hospital.
And so it is my great pleasure and honor to open up Children's Hospital's very own genital ward.
We got a school bus crash off the 495. 50 kids badly injured, broken bones, some of them retarded, the whole deal, and they're coming here.
So you're saying that there is a law that says we cannot test new drugs on rare pandas?
That's what I am saying.
Really?
Rob Corddry, who created it and who's in it, as a doctor with absolutely no education and dresses like a clown, John Stern and David Wayne are the three main creators. And I want to tell you, they are the deal. I'm not allowed to call the show wacky. I'm supposed to say meta. It's meta comedy and or deconstructionist comedy. Whatever it is, I just kept my head down. I did whatever they told me because I didn't understand what the hell I was doing.
And what are you doing in the show? Who are you?
I'm the executive, the chief executive that runs the hospital. But let me just say, I have no idea how to do that. He is a little lost.
I just got a call from corporate. I have to rip $3,000 right out of the budget.
Yeah.
I have to get rid of the coffee maker.
Si.
Great coffee, Si.
People finally started liking you when you got that coffee maker. No, no. If you have to save some money, fire a doctor.
A doctor? Who?
Who cares?
No, no, no. I'll just keep watch and watch carefully at which doctor is least good at her job.
So you have Megan Mullally of Will and Grace, who plays the head of the hospital. She's
right.
On crutches, much like the character on ER, who was always on crutches.
Yes, and I think she throws, maybe I shouldn't say this, but she literally throws her crutches away and replaces them with a walker.
Oh, it's a miracle.
It's a miracle. Ken Marino, Lake Bell, Aaron Hayes, Miss Ackerman. Malin Ackerman is so funny. And I'm telling you, and I get to stand there and I watch these people.
Michael Cera, who's that brilliant actor from Arrested Development.
I worked with him.
Yep.
I had a great time with him.
Well, he doesn't appear on screen in Children's Hospital. He's a staffer that you hear over the intercom a la MASH. In fact, is his character Sal Viscuso? Isn't that the name of the PA announcer in MASH?
It's very possible.
Attention staff, thanks to all of you for not remembering my birthday. Attention staff, will Captain Pierce please report to Colonel Blake? That is all.
Thanks.
And then I had a breakfast with two producers, two other producers, and I had pancakes at that breakfast. And they asked me about their show and what I like to be in their show, and I was so nervous that I took my syrup and I poured it all over my pancakes until I looked down and realized I had poured the cream from my coffee. And then I made up that, well, you know, pancakes are made from buttermilk, and I just wanted the extra zazz of that taste.
And were they asking you to be in Royal Pains?
They asked me to be in Royal Pains, and I got to be with Mark Feuerstein and Paolo Costanzo.
Well, now, wait a second, Henry Winkler. I just have to ask you because
Yes. These
are, you know, it's a very successful show, but these are some young people starting out. You're Henry Winkler. You were nervous?
No. I'm an actor. I'm out there. I'm looking for work. I got this wonderful work, and I'm part of two ensembles. It is just joyful. And I'm not kidding. I would like to say something derogatory about either show. I haven't yet found what it is. Mm. Oh, I know what it is. Mm. The sandwiches on the set of Royal Pains could be on better bread.
Damning.
Yeah, that I'm not kidding. They could use like a really good whole grain bread for the tuna fish sandwich. That would be great. They used kind of like this tortilla that's really doughy.
Royal Pains on USA is about two brothers. They're in the Hamptons on Long Island.
Of them is a doctor.
Yep.
Was fired. He is now a concierge doctor for Campbell Scott's character. His brother, The doctor's brother is the kind of CEO of the concierge business, and I am their long-lost father who might be a little shady.
But it's funny.
It's a dramedy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I get to be this father who has a great relationship with one son and a horrible relationship with the other son. I want to make the relationship better. I keep on invading. I'm invasive in their life.
Well, Henry Winkler, while we have you, those are the two current shows you're in, Royal Pains and Children's Hospital. We want to ask you as well about another part. You played the family lawyer Barry Zuckerkorn on Arrested Development.
Now, here's another. See, this is another great adventure that I fell into. I was hired to do one episode, and I wound up doing 2.5 years.
We want to note, too, that just so we get to say his name, that when you left that role of the family lawyer on Arrested Development, the character was taken over by your fellow Happy Days alum, Scott Baio.
That's right.
And his character is named...
Blah, blah, blah,
blah. Blah, blah,
blah. Blah, blah, right? Something like that.
Are you a CEO, CFO, or other executive facing these or similar charges?
Why should you go to jail for a crime someone else noticed? You don't need double talk. You need blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah. No habla español.
Well, we're not here to talk nonsense to blah, blah, blah.
How much fun do you have?
Well, I have to tell you something. Without sounding I don't know what, I think the cornerstones of one's life are gratitude, and the other one is tenacity. And I think that with those two things, with those two concepts, you can forge a wonderful life.
Henry Winkler, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
What a pleasure, really. Have a great rest of your summer.
Henry Winkler stars in Royal Pains Thursdays at 10 on the USA Network, and he'll debut on the show Children's Hospital. That begins this Sunday at 10:30 on the Cartoon Network's Adult Swim lineup.